For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. A South Carolina school officer has been fired after video showed him flipping an allegedly disruptive teen backward out of her desk and tossing her across the classroom. Richland County Senior Deputy Ben Fields was first suspended after the incident went public. He was released from his job late this morning. Sheriff Leon Lott says Fields did not follow proper procedures and training. The student had been told by a teacher and administrator to leave the classroom, but refused to do so. She also refused the deputy who told her she was under arrest. After her continued refusal to leave, the incident that led to his firing occurred. The FBI has begun a civil rights investigation at the sheriff's request. An autopsy detailing how a 17-year-old Durham girl was killed has been released. The report shows Tierra Hall was stabbed 14 times in the head, neck, shoulder, and arm, then left to die in a vacant home. The medical examiner noted the attack was so brutal, the tip of the knife broke off in the victim's cheek. Hall's former boyfriend, Kelton Fox, also 17, has been charged with first-degree murder in her death. For the third time, Republicans looking to become president square off, this time with a new front runner. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern has more from Boulder, Colorado.
As has been the case twice already, the large Republican field is split into two groups, the higher polling 10 candidates in prime time, the lower polling four in an earlier undercard. Both stages will look nearly the same as last month, minus Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has ended his bid. What is different? The top of the GOP field, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, now leading a few polls in Iowa and a new national CBS New York Times poll. Trump is still running second, well ahead of the rest of the pack, but has spent this week not just critical of those polls, but also Carson, who he calls low energy. In Boulder, Colorado, Jared Halpern, Fox News Radio.
A Georgia woman was arrested in Fayetteville Tuesday on multiple charges dating back to July 9th. Dundra Merrill, a 24-year-old from Brunswick, Georgia, was charged with multiple counts of assault when she fired a gun into a vehicle, wounding one of the passengers. When confronted, she then opened fire on a police officer. Merrill is now being held at Cumberland County Detention Center. The governor signed one of the last remaining bills from the past legislative session into law at the Guilford County Sheriff's Office this afternoon. That's according to WTVD. HB 318 is a highly controversial bill which prevents local municipalities from adopting sanctuary city status. It also prohibits the use of the matricula consular, a photo ID issued by the Mexican government to nationals outside the country. The bill also prevents DHHS from processing applications for able-bodied adults without children from receiving additional benefits. Norman Smith, a 52-year-old stabbing victim, died last night after being attacked by a 29-year-old in Raleigh. Kevin Peacock from Oklahoma was charged early today in connection to the crime. Authorities say the stabbing was not random. A motive has not been released. Additional information has been released in the death of a 2-year-old Henderson County girl. Abigail Newman was shot in the neck with a 20-gauge shotgun over the weekend. She died at Mission Hospital from her injuries. The homeowner, James Stepp, has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. He turned himself in Monday night. Is the tax man spying on you? It's possible. Fox News Radio's Rachel Sutherland reports from Washington.
The IRS admits it's using cell phone tracking equipment, which can collect metadata, but only in criminal cases.
The use of that is restricted. It's our criminal investigation division that uses that technique.
IRS Commissioner John Koskinen told the Senate Finance Committee the agency has to get a court order to use tracking technology, and he stressed it's used primarily for cases like money laundering, terrorism, and organized crime. Koskinen agreed to tell the committee how often the technology is used within 30 days. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland, Fox News Radio.
And a recent article in USA Today shows that App State is one of only 5 universities in the U.S. offering a degree in brewing beer, and the only one on the East Coast. The Bachelor's of Science in Fermentation Sciences was introduced in 2012. The program focuses on the chemistry aspect of brewing beer and offers an in-depth, hands-on approach where students partner with local breweries and vineyards to simulate their own brewery. Other schools offering a similar degree include Oregon State University, University of California, Davis, Central Washington University, and San Diego State. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now it's time to find out what matters with guest host Elliot Engstrom.
Please stand by.
We now take you live to the Institute of Rational Thought for a special broadcast.
hard-hitting interviews and relevant information to make your day. It's Chad Adams.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Freedom Action Network. My name is Elliot Engstrom. I'm in guest hosting today for Chad Adams, who is our regular host. And so it's going to be a bit of an exciting day for everyone involved, I think. And we have a great show lined up for you today. You're not just going to have to listen to me talk for 2 hours. We have some great guests on here for you. Starting out today, we're going to have Miss Andrea Dillon, the blogger of Lady Liberty. And I believe we have her on with us right now. Andrea?
Yes. How are you, Elliot?
Doing all right. How are you?
Doing just fine.
So I have, right off the bat, a couple things I want to talk to you about today.
Okay.
And I can barely even decide what I want to talk about first. But we'll start with your... you put up a blog post at your blog, Lady Liberty 1885, which is a fairly well-read blog about everything, you know, North Carolina, everything political in North Carolina, but with a focus on education. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, in the last three or four years, it's taken a sort of an education turn. I've gotten more into the education activist side of things since Common Core came along.
Yeah. So, so this blog's interesting. You're talking about Representative Brian Holloway, who recently announced that he'll be leaving the General Assembly. And
yeah.
if I can read real quick an outtake from the Stokes News and then kind of get your thoughts on this. The news is saying that Representative Holloway announced Friday that he will be resigning from the North Carolina House of Representatives immediately to pursue a position with the North Carolina School Boards Association. So can you give us a background, first off, on what is the North Carolina School Boards Association? And then second off, what would Representative Holloway be doing there?
Well, the School Boards Association is an association that works together with the different school superintendents and school boards around the state. It looks to me like Holloway is moving into a position where he's going to be a government relations liaison. To me, that sort of read more lobbying side of the House.
Okay.
That they wanted to have someone who had been in the House of Representatives and now, you know, would know the players on the ground and would be able to hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me what it sounded like.
So is this something where you think this is someone's experience in the General Assembly that's going to serve them well in you know, the nonprofit sector? Or do you think there are problems with people going from the General Assembly into these kind of lobbying positions?
Well, I think that his experience will definitely serve him well. He was involved in a lot of the education stuff going on at the legislature. He was involved with the Legislative Research Commission for Common Core, as a matter of fact. So I think that he sort of has an inside track in regards to how the policy plays out and the players at work. In terms of sort of a revolving door scenario like we have in Washington, D.C., where we see legislators or aides or whatnot going over to K Street, you know, and becoming lobbyists or working for associations similar to this, you know, it's going to happen at the state level just like it happens at the federal level.
Hmm. Okay, that's interesting. So because we hear this phrase, the revolving door, at least in reference to D.C. all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean to you? I mean, is that just because a lot of times I think private sector, right? I think people going from a government position to somewhere where they can make a bunch of money at a private company, you know, where they like with Obamacare, you have people who wrote the rules on Obamacare, then went to work for consulting firms that help people navigate Obamacare, right?
Well, yeah. There's a bit of a boys club thing going on there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably say, where, you know, all the players know each other and it just makes for smoother sailing for whatever agenda or policy item they want to go forward with. I don't know that necessarily it's a horribly bad thing. It's a malicious thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really speak well in terms of, you know, keeping the public in the loop. We already see that our school boards have been had end runs done around them by business in getting into the education business.
Mm-hmm.
across the state and across the country. Actually, Common Core was a prime example of that, with Bill Gates and his billions of dollars pumped into a set of standards, which then were, you know, adopted nationwide.
Mm.
Along with the proliferation of nonprofits springing up behind it to garner support in a sort of a Potemkin village sort of scenario. I do think that it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and it'll be interesting to see their balance sheets and 990s and things going forward. We'd have no idea what kind of compensation he'll be receiving for this. So, I mean, he could be making, you know, a fiscal jump as well as, you know, perhaps positioning himself for something else in education in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, I think it's encouraging to see a Republican getting involved on a policy level with a group like this, but by the same token, you know, not everything that's come out of this legislature education-wise in the last few years in terms of policy has been great. I mean, they basically adopted Common Core and put it in our state statutes without really doing the due diligence. So, you know, it's got two sides of the coin there. I think we're going to have to wait and see how it sifts out.
Would you be in favor of a legislatively mandated cooling off period between, you know, the private nonprofit sector and the government sector?
Well, yeah, I think that might actually be prudent, given the amount of power and influence that these people take with them, you know, the connections that they take with them. You know, I mean, are they doing it for altruistic means in order to further a cause of theirs, or are they doing it, you know, purely out of, you know, personal interest? So, you know, that cooling off period might help sort that out a little.
I think that's interesting. I mean, it's something that I honestly haven't thought enough about to really have a very intelligent opinion on. But that's interesting that idea is out there. And I honestly don't know at the federal level to what extent that's happened. But, you know, I was wondering when I read this article about Representative Holloway, and if this is a factor at all. A lot of, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people in the General Assembly are upset at how long the session went this year, because this is supposed to be, you know, a part-time gig. And they're paid on a part-time basis, and yet they were here, what? I mean, January through September, and particularly for the ones far away. And I wonder now, I don't know with his particular situation how long this has been planned, right? But I have to wonder if that has anything to do with this. You know, getting to leave what, for some of them, seems like a full-time job where you don't get paid full-time to go work in a policy position where you probably maybe work.
Well, I'm sure it's appealing.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's appealing. We've seen a lot of other education officials leave for other positions that were higher paying in the private sector when, you know, things got too messy or things got too out of hand. Like, I would say the former superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg, Heath Morrison, you know, at one point he's saying, oh, I want to go spend time with my mother, my sick mother in Virginia or something along those lines. And then the next thing we know, he's working for a major publishing company as a vice president role. I'm sure that comes with a very large salary considering what he left with. So, you know.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're here at Freedom Action Network, housed within the Civitas Institute, same as the Center for Law and Freedom where I work. And we're conservatives. We're all about cutting the budget. But that's one of those ideas where even conservatives, you've heard peeps throughout the office, and I don't know if we have consensus on this, but there's this idea that maybe we should be raising pay if the sessions are going to be this long, or we should be mandating that the sessions be shorter. I mean, you know, but and I know that's not the issue in your blog post, but it's just something that kind of...
Well, by the same token, though, you wanted to make sure that they got the budget right. I mean,
that's true.
You didn't want them to hammer out something that wasn't, you know, that wasn't in the best interest of everybody, and I think maybe that they took the extra time to make sure that happened.
That is true.
I think you'd have to look at the historical length of some of the sessions too. I can't imagine that this one was the longest one. you know, historically, I have a feeling that if we reached into the past somewhere, that we'd probably find some other comparable years.
I bet you're right on that. I don't know off the top of my head. I had another thing I wanted to chat with you about today. I want to know if we should be praising President Obama. And you know, we're a nonpartisan think tank, but I think that generally on most things we don't agree with President Obama a lot. You know, a lot of the time. I saw this article, I think, what's today? Today's the 28th, about 2 days ago, in the Miami newspaper, that President Obama has come out and called for fewer tests in public schools. I have two questions. And to preface this, let me briefly say that standardized testing is an issue that I'm very passionate about, Andrea is very passionate about, and the concern is that there's so much testing in schools that one, kids are getting fatigued from this, and then two, teachers don't have time to teach. And so this article comes out where President Obama is saying less testing. So first off, is what he's saying a good idea? And I know I actually didn't send you this particular article ahead of time, but he's generally saying...
Well, no, it's funny that you mentioned this, because tomorrow my article over at the Tech Guy blog, which I do once a week over there, is going to be about this topic.
Okay.
So I dug into this quite a bit this morning, and... what I find funny is that after 7 years of this presidency and continuing the failed policies of No Child Left Behind and the test and punish scenario and tying it to teacher evaluations, and they've been hammering this and hammering this and hammering this, that the year before presidential election, we see him completely reverse course and basically slam his own policies. Now, within moments of this news breaking, we had Randy Weingarten, the head of the NEA, on Twitter praising it and talking about what a wonderful, refreshing change this is. And, you know, it begs the question, you know, is this basically laying, you know, political groundwork for 2016, you know, getting the teacher unions back into favor, because right now they're really mad at this administration about the testing and about the teacher evaluations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that ties into it. And also, you know, this administration has subtly been beating Hillary Clinton over the head with various issues, and Hillary Clinton has come out in favor of Common Core and in favor of accountability, including standardized testing and that sort of thing, as being a necessary evil and whatnot. So you got to wonder if there's not a politically convenient aspect to this role reversal suddenly, and the fact that Common Core has just, you know, thrown parents nationwide into a tizzy, and the tests associated with it have made everyone upset. New York is opting out in droves. And, you know, this new revelation comes just, you know, a week or so after Arne Duncan decides to resign and go off into whatever he's going to do, and John King from New York sweeps in, who's had all these testing problems.
Yeah.
You got to wonder about the timing of it. This administration has a bad habit of doing one thing with one hand and another thing with another hand. So, you know, I think that it should be taken with a gigantic grain of salt.
And that's what was confusing to me is that I honestly don't think I've researched these issues as thoroughly as you have, but it is my understanding that in North Carolina we have a lot of standardized tests. We have end of grade test, end of course test, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of this thing at the end of the day is actually driven by federal policy, even whether federal...
Well, yeah, it's driven by the Education and Secondary Act. It's driven by the No Child Left Behind and the waivers that went along with it. It's driven by... Much of it is driven by federal policy. And when it comes to the end-of-grade courses and that sort of thing, most of those scores are actually being used towards the A through F grading system to grade the schools. It's not really actually counting towards anything for the students for the most part.
Yeah.
Now, when you get to the end of course stuff in high school, of course, that counts towards some grades and whatnot. But, you know, you've at any given point in a third grader's life, for example, they'll be subjected to some 95-something plus assessments during the year.
Hmm. I mean, that boggles my mind. I mean, I think about when I was a kid that age, how hyper I was, I could not imagine having to sit still for. I can do that now. Heck,
they're 8 and 9 year olds, right? You know, and they're supposed to sit through these tests. So they, in the beginning of the year, they have the BOG, which is the beginning of grade, and then they end up doing an academically gifted test at some point, which was like a week or so ago, to see if any of them shake out for that. And then next week we find out that because of Read to Achieve, they've managed to get out of doing M class for reading, but they're doing M class exams for math, and. That was in second grade, and in third grade they choose the Case 21 test for that instead. So they got that, and then they're also bombarded. I don't think parents really realize how much they're bombarded with Common Core assessments in the classroom. Every single standard that they're working on, whatever grade level it is they're working on, there are these little, in Wake County at least, there are these little black line master assessments, and when they get to the end of a unit, they have to do this little assessment, and that creates their score.
Wow. It amazes me because, you know, I'm 27 years old. I'm a barred attorney in North Carolina. I think I'm reasonably, you know, competent, functioning adult. Mm-hmm. And I even think about the length of some of these tests, and I think, could I do that?
Yeah.
I mean, could I sit still for this long and just focus on this? Like, I work here at Civitas. Every hour or so, I'll get up. I'll just kind of 2 minutes.
Well, in third grade, then you had the Read to Achieve stuff too. So if they don't test out in the BOG for the Read to Achieve, then they have Read to Achieve added to them.
Mm.
You know, and a lot of kids, you know, barely just made it because on the BOG, which is now Common Core aligned, you know, if you don't make a certain score, you get dumped into a Read to Achieve thing. So it's, you know, it cuts both ways. And a lot of kids, like my son in particular, his scores for reading, it's three different. There's three different portions to it. There's a fluency, there's a lexile, and there's the reading comprehension. Now, the reading comprehension piece is very much Common Core driven, and it is asking these kids to do some really hard stuff that may not be appropriate for their grade level. That's another topic for another day.
Yeah.
But for example, my kid in fluency, the target was something like 95 or something like that, and he hit 107.
Wow.
No, I'm sorry. The target for that was 70, and he hit 107. In the Lexile part, it was the target was 95, and he hit 98. But when the reading comprehension came around, which was like four or five passages, multiple paragraphs with multiple questions that go with it, he barely bumped above the score that was needed to get out of Read to Achieve.
Wow.
So, you know, he's reading at a fourth grade level, but he would have been tagged for read to achieve if he hadn't gotten through that comprehension piece. And the comprehension piece was so long that by the end of it, he was phoning it in. He even told me that. He's like, Mom, I got tired near the end. I just couldn't keep doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are we doing to these kids, you know?
You know, I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of your blog is that you're a parent, too. And you have your kids are, how old are they? They're elementary school age?
Yeah, I've got an 8-year-old in third grade, and I have a 5-year-old who I held out of kindergarten this year. He just turned 5 over the summer, and I wasn't ready to send him to kindergarten quite yet. Yeah. I wanted to see how the Academic Standards Review Commission's findings would pan out first before putting him into kindergarten. And also, I just didn't feel like he had the maturity to go there quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
Boys tend to mature a little bit slower than girls, and he has a tough time sitting still as it is right now, and I couldn't imagine forcing him to go to kindergarten at this point. So we've been doing a little bit of homeschooling and whatnot, and he can already write his name. He can read basic little texts. He can count to 100 all by himself. He has all the kindergarten skills, but he's just not, you know, mentally ready to be there yet.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of parents feel like when your child turns 5, it's a magic number. Oh, we send them to kindergarten regardless. No, you have a choice. You can keep your kid home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to send them right away. They can go when they're 6. Why are we rushing our kids into a system that they're going to be in for, you know, 12, 13, 14, however many years? I mean, it's let them be kids for a little while.
Yeah. And, you know, on that note, I know we're keeping you a little longer than I told you I would, but if that's all right, I have one more question for you. Your blog in general, and this is more less about, you know, policies and all that, but your blog, you've got, I'm looking here, you got about 4,200 something followers on Twitter, and then when you write stuff, you know, people tend to react to whether it's for good or bad in state government. And I think some people are curious, you know, I'm getting emails and text messages from people asking, how did you get that following? Like, did you just one day just start blogging? I mean, how did you do that?
Well, you know, people have asked me that before. They, you know, people who have started their own blogs have asked me how I got to where I am today. And I started blogging 5-6 years ago, I think it was. And originally, you know, I had very few followers, very few notifications that anyone was following the blog. But going into the second year of it, I got on Facebook. I created a fan page for it. And I just started telling it like it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was blunt. I was out there. And I used a little bit of my patented powdered sarcasm. And the next thing I knew, I had people coming out of the woodwork following my blog. And now I've got over 10,000 email subscribers. So it's sort of blossomed. And from there, you know, people started to take note. I went to conferences. I talked to other bloggers. I did other events and made some inroads, and then I started getting communications with other blogs outside of the state, the Tech Guy being one. He's a top 50 conservative blog in the country, and he hired me to come on board and write there once a week, and the next thing I knew, the Heartland Institute was knocking on my door wanting me to write over at their Fiscal Times group, so I started doing that.
Wow.
And so I'm spreading myself a little thin, and hopefully in the coming weeks, people will start to see a few articles from me dropping over at Civitas's blog.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be trying to do some education work over there, and I got involved with Civitas doing the Stop Common Core NC blog as well,
mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, I think when you write from a point of passion, you write from a point of personal experience, that comes through in the writing, and I think that genuine sentiment is what people are looking for. They're not looking for someone who's just giving you a 30,000-foot view. They want someone who's actually looked into the item and can offer you the resources to look further yourself.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, I love reading the blog. I hope more people keep reading it, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on here today and talk with us a little bit.
No problem. I appreciate it, and it's always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you later.
And that was Andrea Dillon of Lady Liberty blog. If you ever follow the Plot Hound or Carolina Plot Hound or anything like that, you'll see content from her on a pretty regular basis. We kind of jumped right in today. So quickly before we go to break, I believe we have a break at 3:30 here. Wanted to fill you guys in on who I am and why you're hearing my voice today instead of the melodious voice of Chad Adams.
So Chad's out today, and we needed a guest host, and I was.
And you would call it Melodious, Elliot.
Yes.
Only you would call it Melodious.
Yes. I like Chad. I've actually been a guest on here a few times with Chad. You may have heard me, but my name is Elliot Engstrom, and I'm a staff attorney with a group called the Center for Law and Freedom, and we're a public interest law firm housed here at Civitas. So we've got all kinds of litigation stuff going on, and I'm actually not going to talk too much about that today. Although, if you are interested, call in 919-747-9421. And I'd be more than happy to fill in callers on any of the cases that we've got going on. But today, what we are going to be focused on is a few interviews we've got lined up. So we just talked with Andrea Dillon and so we just talked with Andrea Dillon of Lady Liberty about some educational issues. We actually have Dr. Bob Lukey, who is a senior policy analyst here at Civitas, coming in at 3:35, just after the news break, to talk to us about education savings account and what those are. And we might actually play devil's advocate a little bit and throw some of these ideas out there about, you know, these things are, you hear from people on the left sometimes that this is a wrong use of taxpayer money and all that. And we're going to see, you know, how those arguments hold up. At 4:05 today, we've got a guy named Anthony Rodriguez coming in. He's from a group called Young Americans for Liberty up in Washington, D.C. And Anthony, while he is their central regional director overseeing states like Texas, he's from North Carolina. So we're going to talk about some North Carolina and national issues. And then to close out the show later today, we'll have a guy named Jonathan Jones, director of the Open Government Coalition at Elon University, who is all about transparency and public records. And he's pretty much, as far as I know, the number one guru on public records in North Carolina. So we're excited about the show today. And every now and then we might give you a little description of one of the cases we're doing at the Center for Law and Freedom. And in fact, do I have time to go over a case real quick, or do we need to break?
You've got plenty of time. You've got about 3.5 minutes.
Okay. Well, you know, just so right now we've got several active cases at the Center for Law and Freedom. And part of the reason I don't stick on this too long is because while it's really exciting in the courtroom, it can be really boring to hear about,
You're never boring,
Elliot. Her talk out. But one thing is the wind energy cases, and I've been on here talking to Chad about this a little bit. There are wind turbines going up in several spots in North Carolina. Part of that is because there's apparently new technology that's come out, several different reasons. But for wind energy developers, North Carolina is a more attractive state than it once was, partially also because of government incentive grants. But that's an issue we'll get into another day. But basically, we have two lawsuits right now, one in Wake County Superior Court and one in the Office of Administrative Hearings, questioning whether the Department of Environmental Quality did its job correctly, actually did its job legally, when it told Iberdrola Renewables, which is a European-based company building turbines in North Carolina, that their project was not subject to North Carolina regulatory law. This is about, for us, it's about rule of law. And for our clients, it's about, it's about rule of law for them also. But we have some clients in Pequimans County and in Pasquotank County who are worried about some of the largest wind turbines that have ever been built in the world going up right next to their property.
And aren't these things really huge too?
So my analogy that I use, and you know, I try to make sure I use fair analogies. So I'm not going to call them, you know, like when you Google, sometimes you see pictures where there'll be like 5 or 6 turbines going up in flames and stuff right. Like that. That happens sometimes, but not to the, I don't use that as one of my analogies because I just don't think it happens enough to be fair. But what I do think is fair is to say that they're about as tall as the PNC Tower in downtown Raleigh, and the blades are about the size of a jumbo jet.
Wow.
So I think in Pequimans County, they're about 499 feet. And then in Pasquotank County, the ones that are going to go up are closer to 570 feet. But I may have just reversed those two. But anyways, so that's just one example of what we're doing here at the center. That's a convoluted way of saying that we're about the rule of law. We're about property rights. We're about constitutional liberties. And we've got lots of different cases going on. But today, what we're here to do is to tell you about what's happening in North Carolina in terms of North Carolina politics and policy. We got a good lineup for that. And so I think we'll go to a break real quick, and then we'll be right back to talk to Dr. Bob Lukey.
Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. A South Carolina school officer has been fired after video showed him flipping an allegedly disruptive teen backward out of her desk and tossing her across the classroom. Richland County Senior Deputy Ben Fields was first suspended after the incident went public. He was released from his job late this morning. Sheriff Leon Lott says Fields did not follow proper procedures and training. The student had been told by a teacher and administrator to leave the classroom, but refused to do so. She also refused the deputy who told her she was under arrest. After her continued refusal to leave, the incident that led to his firing occurred. The FBI has begun a civil rights investigation at the sheriff's request. An autopsy detailing how a 17-year-old Durham girl was killed has been released. The report shows Tierra Hall was stabbed 14 times in the head, neck, shoulder, and arm, then left to die in a vacant home. The medical examiner noted the attack was so brutal, the tip of the knife broke off in the victim's cheek. Hall's former boyfriend, Kelton Fox, also 17, has been charged with first-degree murder in her death. For the third time, Republicans looking to become president square off, this time with a new frontrunner. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern has more from Boulder, Colorado.
As has been the case twice already, the large Republican field is split into two groups, the higher polling 10 candidates in prime time, the lower polling four in an earlier undercard. Both stages will look nearly the same as last month, minus Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has ended his bid. What is different? The top of the GOP field, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, now leading a few polls in Iowa and a new national CBS New York Times poll. Trump is still running second, well ahead of the rest of the pack, but has spent this week not just critical of those polls, but also Carson, who he calls low energy. In Boulder, Colorado, Jared Halpern, Fox News Radio.
A Georgia woman was arrested in Fayetteville Tuesday on multiple charges dating back to July 9th. Dundra Merrill, a 24-year-old from Brunswick, Georgia, was charged with multiple counts of assault when she fired a gun into a vehicle, wounding one of the passengers. When confronted, she then opened fire on a police officer. Merrill is now being held at Cumberland County Detention Center. The governor signed one of the last remaining bills from the past legislative session into law at the Guilford County Sheriff's Office this afternoon. That's according to WTVD. HB 318 is a highly controversial bill which prevents local municipalities from adopting sanctuary city status. It also prohibits the use of the matricula consular, a photo ID issued by the Mexican government to nationals outside the country. The bill also prevents DHHS from processing applications for able-bodied adults without children from receiving additional benefits. Norman Smith, a 52-year-old stabbing victim, died last night after being attacked by a 29-year-old in Raleigh. Kevin Peacock from Oklahoma was charged early today in connection to the crime. Authorities say the stabbing was not random. A motive has not been released. Additional information has been released in the death of a 2-year-old Henderson County girl. Abigail Newman was shot in the neck with a 20-gauge shotgun over the weekend. She died at Mission Hospital from her injuries. The homeowner, James Stepp, has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. He turned himself in Monday night. Is the tax man spying on you? It's possible. Fox News Radio's Rachel Sutherland reports from Washington.
The IRS admits it's using cell phone tracking equipment, which can collect metadata, but only in criminal cases.
The use of that is restricted. It's our criminal investigation division that uses that technique.
IRS Commissioner John Koskinen told the Senate Finance Committee the agency has to get a court order to use tracking technology, and he stressed it's used primarily for cases like money laundering, terrorism, and organized crime. Koskinen agreed to tell the committee how often the technology is used within 30 days. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland, Fox News Radio.
And a recent article in USA Today shows that App State is one of only 5 universities in the U.S. offering a degree in brewing beer, and the only one on the East Coast. The Bachelor's of Science in Fermentation Sciences was introduced in 2012. The program focuses on the chemistry aspect of brewing beer and offers an in-depth, hands-on approach where students partner with local breweries and vineyards to simulate their own brewery. Other schools offering a similar degree include Oregon State University, University of California, Davis, Central Washington University, and San Diego State. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of what matters with guest host Elliot Engstrom.
Welcome back to the Freedom Action Network. I am Elliot Engstrom, filling in today for Chad Adams. We have in the studio with us today Dr. Bob Lukey, who is a senior policy analyst at the Civitas Institute. And hello, Bob. How are you doing?
Welcome. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, so we got a few really pressing issues to talk about today. We got educational issues that will likely affect, you know, the future of my children, my children's children, my children's children's children. But first off, what's really important, the Carolina Panthers are 6-0. And that is just unprecedented. And I just thought we needed to mention that and talk about the fact that
that's a very good segue.
The Packers are going to get their first loss in Charlotte in about a week and a half. But, Dr. Bob is a lifelong Packers fan.
Best seg ever. Thank you for the laugh today.
Just a minute, I think I lost myself turning that corner.
Oh yeah,
get back in the car. Yeah.
Well, but anyways, all right. So that being said, education savings accounts. You guys are doing an event on this in Charlotte, right?
November 10th. But let's back up a little bit, Elliot.
Okay,
you are an attorney.
I am.
And you've done a very good job since you've been here. I know you've been around the periphery of what we're talking about as far as education savings accounts.
Yes.
But let's back up a little bit and why don't you tell me what you know about education savings accounts? Because our event in Charlotte on November 10th is kind of a kickoff of a statewide education campaign. And it's really important for us to make sure that the public is aware of what education savings accounts are, how they can be benefit people, and how they're good for children, they're good for our schools, they're good for our state. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I'm kind of reversing the interview
a little. No, bit. It's fine. But, thanks for having me on the show, Dr. Bob. And my general understanding is education savings accounts are kind of like super vouchers. That's my understanding of you know, looking at it. It's basically parents that get money from the state in lieu of public education that can go towards any expenses that have to do with education. I think that's kind of the broad definition of what it is. But honestly, I don't work on this policy stuff as much as you do, so I'm not one of the reasons I know anything about it is because I interned at Goldwater Institute out in Arizona, and they've been pushing these things for years. But I was wondering if you could fill us in on, you know, why should we have education savings accounts? Why is this a good idea?
That's a very good point, Elliot. And that's why let me jump in here, because we're very concerned about what the public knows or doesn't know about education savings accounts. And that's the main point in why we're doing what we're doing. As you know, North Carolina has about 2,500 public schools. And a lot of the schools do a really great job. And a lot of parents entrust their kids at those schools. But we also know that there are a number of schools that are failing our kids, that they either don't offer the quality education that they should, or even if they do offer a quality education, the kids aren't, it's not a good fit for a child in a family, or it's just not the best place where a child could flourish. Mm-hmm. So those are realities. We all know that. And we all hope the best for our kids. We want them to have a bright future, and education is a very important part of that. And unfortunately, a lot of our children today are stuck or trapped in schools where that future is dim. Mm-hmm. And what education savings accounts do is they help us to address that problem. Five states currently have education savings accounts. As you alluded to before, Arizona was the first state that passed education savings accounts in 2011. The four other states are Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Nevada. Florida and Arizona had programs in existence prior to this year. The other three I mentioned were all passed this year. So their programs have been approved, but they haven't quite been implemented yet. Mm-hmm. But basically what an ESA is, as you said before, it is a parent-controlled account that it's funded by a percentage of the state per pupil support that follows the child to a particular school. It's different from it is different from a voucher, and the difference is significant because A voucher is provided to a student or a family for an express purpose.
That's for tuition?
Tuition, okay. Or whatever designated purpose. Okay. An ESA gives a parent total control over an account, and the funds in that account can be used for a variety of different purposes. For example, like for tuition, for books, for educational services like test preparation, things like that. It gives parents total control over the child's education and what form that they want that to develop as. So it's a much more powerful tool than a voucher. And in many ways, it can revolutionize education.
Now, here's my question. So one of the counterarguments I hear to this is you give people education savings accounts, right? And these parents are going to go out and they're going to go buy cars, and they're going to go buy Twinkies, and they're going to go buy whatever, not spend the money on their children. Kids are going to be left without an education, and then, you know, it all goes downhill from there.
There's yeah. ways to get around that. Yeah. There are ways to construct closed systems so that purchases that have to be made online, you would only be authorized to make transactions for certain items, and they're called closed electronic systems. Mm-hmm. In other words, there'd be a text box that would open up on an online system, and you'd be able to make purchases for such and such certain services or certain items, and they'd either be approved or not be approved. Also, you can also create a debit card that can only work in certain places. So it's a legitimate question, but there are ways to address those concerns.
And one of the most interesting things about that argument to me, because I hear that a lot, right, is that aren't there a lot of welfare systems that work based on you can only buy certain things? Like you can't, I don't know for sure this is the case, but it's my understanding that there's certain forms of welfare that you can't buy, like liquor or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, right? That's a good analogy, because you could construct something similar to that, that there would only be an approved list of items that you could purchase with the designated card.
And I have to wonder, I always try to assume that the people on the other side of whatever issue I'm working on aren't necessarily like evil or whatever. They just have a disagreement with me that it might be reasonable and we can work it out, right? But it seems that at least sometimes bureaucrats see parents as this like barrier, and that the parent is actually in between them and the child, and that the parent is keeping them from doing what they want with the child in schools. And I wonder if that's where some of the, because this gives parents more control, right? ESAs, it gives parents more control over what their kids learn, you know, where their kids are during the day, those kind of things. And I wonder if that's what some of the battle is going to be. Just, do we trust parents or do we trust bureaucrats? Like, who do we trust more?
Well, that definitely is going to come into play. Unfortunately, on both of these sides here, we often deal with extremes. You know, that not, in my view, not all bureaucrats are have bad intentions,
yeah,
but
definitely.
You know, conversely, you know, so we have to realize that oftentimes we're dealing with the margins here, but there also has to be, in my view, there has to be a fundamental acceptance of a premise that the parents have the best interests of their child at heart, and no one else does, and that because of that, we should operate from the fundamental premise that if parents have the best interests of the child at heart, we should empower them to make the what should be the best educational choices. Mm-hmm. Are those always perfect? They may not be, but still, if in 95% of the cases, they probably are the best. We shouldn't go out and make wholesale policy changes just because of a few horror stories.
Mm-hmm. And so the ESA bill, if this were to happen, if there were to be a bill enacted into law or whatever, the bill would say something along the lines of, you can have an ESA, and instead of your child going to public school, you get this much money. Is that how it works?
Well, there are a number of different ways that you can construct a bill. As I said before, there are 5 states that have ESAs. 4 of those states, the legislation was specifically targeted on special needs students.
That's Arizona, right?
Arizona and all the other states, but Nevada. Nevada is a different case. Mm-hmm. But 4 of those 5 states have legislation that was targeted specifically on special needs students, believing in many cases the needs of special needs students are markedly different, in that ESAs can provide a significant benefit for that population. And then assuming that that a program could grow and, you know, over time, you know, mature with other possible populations. Now, that's what Arizona did do.
Yeah.
Arizona did that. They started out initially just with including special needs populations in the legislation, but it has expanded to include about five other populations, which include students that attend failing schools, dependents of military personnel, foster children, I think a couple others. But the point is they've expanded it significantly. Now, a state that went a different direction there was Nevada, which this year passed what's called a universal ESA. What that means is any student who's currently in the public schools, or if you have a child that's about to enter the public schools, i.e. in kindergarten, you will receive a voucher based on your income of between $5,100 and $5,700 to be used at a school of your choice.
And that's if you don't go to public school.
Yes.
So you tell the state, we're not going.
Yes, because you can't keep the money and then enroll back into a school. Most states say it. Make it that if you agree to accept the money, that you're going to remain at the school that you...
Do they deduct that money out of their budget, the state? Because I know in Arizona they had trouble with that, where people were getting ESA money, but then the state wasn't deducting that money out of the school system budget, you know?
The money is supposed to follow the child. And the way it's administered, the way I understand it, there are quarterly payments that are transferred from the school district budget to the student's actual account. The other ones are still being set up, but those are some of the things that need to be, you know, specifically worked out.
And I wonder, you know, as an attorney over here, I wonder if there's going to be, if this were to happen in North Carolina, in Nevada, it was challenged legally, like immediately, right?
Correct.
On legal grounds. And I actually haven't looked into that case quite enough to know all the details. I believe in Arizona, it was also challenged and upheld. The interesting thing is our courts recently upheld vouchers. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, I'm trying to think like a lawyer on the other side and say, if ESAs became reality, how do you say that ESAs, even though vouchers are constitutional, ESAs are not?
You're thinking like a lawyer, Elliot, which you should. And that's a good question. Because I think, obviously, the court's decision in the Reser voucher case strengthened our side case for the legality of vouchers, and I think probably unintentionally.
Well, said they're legal.
ESA is also.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you could come up, there'd have to be some other novel legal argument to be put forth, but in most states, how it's challenged, or at least a common argument has been via the Blaine Amendment, which, briefly put, is a state provision in many state constitutions that prohibits states from providing public money to religious schools.
That was about those darned Catholics in the 1800s.
That's right.
Right.
And actually, some 40 states have them. But North Carolina does not, so that it couldn't be tried on those grounds.
Yeah.
So I think in answer to your question, I think based on, you know, the recent court decision here upholding vouchers, I'm sure it'll be if ESAs are passed, it'll be challenged. But I think the recent court case strengthened our side's case. And, you know, I think it'll be an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. I guess, what is your prognosis for how long would it take to get ESAs in North Carolina? Is this something that could happen next session, or is this?
Well, we're gonna plan on trying to educate citizens about it, trying to educate policymakers. We've been slowly doing that over the last couple of years because we believe that when people understand what ESAs are and how they can help them and how they can help their kids, they're automatically, you know, drawn to them. We look at polling data that's been very supportive. People like them. The concept, they want ESAs, and, you know, we're going to move forward with that. Next year, We hope to get a number of bills introduced and go from there. We believe that there's support for them, and we're hopeful.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. My last question, I alluded to this at the beginning. Who do you think is going to win the Panthers-Packers game in Charlotte? What would you say the score is going to be?
I'd say that, well, let's see. I will take Green Bay 27-20. 27-20.
I'm going, so I'm – we will see. Last year was tough.
I would like to go, too, if somebody wants to give me a ticket.
Oh,
it's below $500.
Yeah. Talking about my children and my children's children's children, I might be my children's children's children who the next time see undefeated Green Bay play undefeated Carolina and Charlotte.
Well, so, yeah. Yes. If we have I just hope it's a good game.
Yeah.
Because last year's game in Green Bay was not. So, but I think it will be in a week. We'll see what will happen.
And of course, that's assuming both teams survive their next game.
That's correct. Actually, Green Bay is going to play two undefeated teams in the next 2 weeks.
All right. Well, so sounds good. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. We look forward to, whenever I'm in here again, having you back.
All right. Thank you, Elliot. Enjoyed it.
And, before we go to our next break, I'm going to give you another little teaser about one of the cases that the Center for Law and Freedom is doing. So I mentioned we've got these wind energy cases in Northeast North Carolina. In addition to the wind energy stuff, we were also dealing with a governmental transparency case, which is interesting because we actually have Jonathan Jones for the Open Government Coalition coming on later. And this is a case in Gaston County. So Gaston County, just west of Charlotte in a city called Belmont, the city of Belmont did an investigation into its police department in 2014 into 2015. And they used a third party company to do this investigation, paid them $80,000 to $90,000 at the last figure I've heard. And we then, on behalf of a family that was seeking this investigation, filed a public records request. And the city told us, well, no, that's a personnel record. You can't have that. It's confidential. Well, we looked at the personnel statute. Personnel statute says that a record is confidential under the personnel statute if it is, one, gathered by the city, and two, with respect to individual employees. So we've got about a 250-page report that was, in our view, gathered by a third-party company specifically because the city did not want to do the investigation itself. So, number one, is this gathered by the city? We argue no. And then number two, is this with respect to individual employees? Because another part of the public records law says that if a document is mixed, if it has confidential and non-confidential information in a report, then it's up to the government agency to redact it and give you what's non-confidential. And we can't imagine that this entire thing is all with respect to individual employees. So we're in a public records lawsuit in Gaston County. We filed, beginning of September. I'm getting my cases mixed up. Yeah, we filed our complaint at the beginning of September. The opposing counsel moved for an extension at the end of September to have an extra 30 days to respond, and law lesson for any of the law students out there, you do not oppose a motion for an extension unless you have a good reason to, because it just kind of makes you a jerk. So you don't do that. And so we actually should be getting either a motion to dismiss or an answer from the other side, this week, next week, something like that. And it's an interesting case because that exact issue went before a judge in Greensboro in 2009, and it was kind of a half win for the plaintiffs. And then it was a third-party investigation about a police department. The plaintiffs kind of got a half win there. And then before it could go to the Court of Appeals, the full thing was leaked, so it never got appealed. So we think it's an interesting issue. We think it's an important issue because, in our opinion, if a government agency is going to spend tens of thousands of dollars to pay a outside agency to investigate, government employee misconduct, that should be public information. But we will see what they say on the other side. And but that's just another one of the cases that we've got going on here at the Center for Law and Freedom. I think it's now time for us to, is it time for us to take a break, or do I have a few more minutes to?
You've got some time, but we can also take a little break.
Oh no, I can keep on going. We've got, because right now we've got four active cases of litigation at the Center for Law and Freedom. And then we also do amicus briefs and stuff like that. So,
Explain exactly what an amicus brief is.
So an amicus brief is a brief that's submitted to the court by a non-party. So, for example, we're planning one right now. There was this case, Kirby versus Department of Transportation, the quote, MAP Act case. And at issue in the MAP Act case was whether, when the state designates corridors for future construction of highways, does that constitute a taking? So if your house is in the middle of happy land, right? Mm-hmm. And the court says, or not the court, a government agency says, we're designating your house for future construction, but we're not building yet. Therefore, we're not taking your house. We're going to build later. Well, what do you think happens to the property of that
it
house?
It devalues your house substantially.
Yeah, gone, right? Mm-hmm. Gone. And so actually a private attorney from Winston-Salem went to the, I think it was Forsyth County Superior Court, and argued that this was a taking. The mm-hmm. Superior Court ruled, no, it's not, because they're not actually taking your property. They're just designating it for basically a future taking,
but
right?
But they're devaluing it.
Well, and I think the argument on the other side would be, if we want this to be considered a taking, then go enact that into law, right? Mm-hmm. So they went up to the Court of Appeals, and the plaintiffs in this case, the ones who were having their house quote-unquote taken, won at the Court of Appeals. The court said you can't designate something for a future taking and then call it not a taking, right? Because because when you think about the policy ramifications of why do we have law that the government has to compensate you for when they take your property, it's because you're losing something, right?
Right.
But you lose a lot of value when they designate something for future construction. So it's now going to the Supreme Court, and we and a group called the Pacific Legal Foundation from California, arguably the biggest conservative law firm in the country, maybe up there with IJ and Goldwater, are submitting an amicus brief. A guy named Mark Miller, and you know, in fairness to him, he's Mark Miller has done most of the principal drafting and research, and then I'm helping him with the nuances of, you know, getting it filed in North Carolina. But that's part of why we're here. Mm-hmm. It's because we make it a lot easier for these outside organizations to file amicus briefs. And so it's a brief going to the Supreme Court. And it's funny because in my non-Civitas capacity as a private citizen, I went to an event with some judges who were running for, just to hear judges speak about their candidacy for the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And one of them actually came up to me afterwards, and when he heard what I did, and said, we need more amicus briefs. Which is funny, because at the United States Supreme Court, I think they use them to, you know, swat flies. I don't know what they do.
Right.
I don't think they read them unless it comes from, you know, somebody they really respect their opinion. But they get a million amicus briefs on everything. Mm-hmm. But at the Court of Appeals, they actually want more amicus briefs.
Wow.
So in state courts, I think it's something that we're trying to work on more here. We've submitted 3 amicus briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court, and one of them I felt really good about. We submitted it with the Cato Institute, but the court didn't do what we wanted, so oh well. So that's an example of what we're doing in state court. An amicus brief is just a chance to put more issues in front of the court. You either put more legal issues in front of the court than either side can fit in their briefs, mm-hmm. or you present them with some policy or history or something that's separate.
Okay.
And so it's an interesting thing, and we're trying to do more of that here. My goal actually is to have, you know, I have one extern now from Campbell Law School working for me named Jonathan Naylor. My goal is to have a bunch of externs here, maybe 3 to 4 externs, and have one of them, or maybe have one of them really just be like, you have this amicus brief and that's what you're working on the whole semester. You know, but we need more externs. So if you're listening and you're a young law student, email me, clf@nccivitas.org.
And you should, because, by the way, you're going to get a lot of good training.
Yeah, well, if you come work here, one of the fun things about working here is that we don't have a paralegal at the Center for Law and Freedom, because we don't have enough, a private attorney has 40 to 50 cases at a time. We mm-hmm. just don't do that kind of caseload. But so I've learned how to file a lawsuit. I've learned what to do with the post office when you're serving a complaint. You know, all those little things you don't learn in law school. But it's really good experience for young law students. And
you're a growing center.
Yeah, we are a growing center. And we're going to need more attorneys and paralegals and everybody else as soon as we can get them. But I think I actually have talked my way.
Well,
to the,
yeah, you're about down to about a minute. Yeah.
I mean, there is more than enough stuff. I could probably come on here and talk for an hour just about CLF and what we do, but I'm afraid people.
Well, who do we have coming up next?
Well, next up at 4 o'clock, we have Anthony Rodriguez from up in D.C. He's a North Carolina native. He's now a regional director for Young Americans for Liberty. We're going to talk to him about the presidential race a little bit.
Oh, cool.
Because he's of the opinion that millennial voters get ignored. And actually, we'll talk about this more, but when you look at some of these polls on CNN and they mention who they're polling, it'll say no one under 50. But you have to go to the back and look at the asterisks. So, I mean, no wonder guys who poll well with younger people are polling poorly, and no wonder Donald Trump's polling so well. But
that's true.
Anyway, so these polls are conducted by phone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, I'm millennial. I don't have that many friends who participate in phone polls, you know.
Well, that's true.
But
good point.
So anyways, and then at 4:30 we got Jonathan Jones from the Open Government Coalition coming on. So it's going to be
good.
It's going to be a good second hour, but thank you everybody for listening in, and if you have your own ideas about any of this stuff, call us up at 919-747-9421.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. A South Carolina school officer has been fired after video showed him flipping an allegedly disruptive teen backward out of her desk and tossing her across the classroom. Richland County Senior Deputy Ben Fields was first suspended after the incident went public. He was released from his job late this morning. Sheriff Leon Lott says Fields did not follow proper procedures and training. The student had been told by a teacher and administrator to leave the classroom, but refused to do so. She also refused the deputy who told her she was under arrest. After her continued refusal to leave, the incident that led to his firing occurred. The FBI has begun a civil rights investigation at the sheriff's request. An autopsy detailing how a 17-year-old Durham girl was killed has been released. The report shows Tierra Hall was stabbed 14 times in the head, neck, shoulder, and arm, then left to die in a vacant home. The medical examiner noted the attack was so brutal, the tip of the knife broke off in the victim's cheek. Hall's former boyfriend, Kelton Fox, also 17, has been charged with first-degree murder in her death. For the third time, Republicans looking to become president square off, this time with a new frontrunner. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern has more from Boulder, Colorado.
As has been the case twice already, the large Republican field is split into two groups, the higher polling 10 candidates in prime time, the lower polling 4 in an earlier undercard. Both stages will look nearly the same as last month, minus Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has ended his bid. What is different? The top of the GOP field, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, now leading a few polls in Iowa and a new national CBS New York Times poll. Trump is still running second, well ahead of the rest of the pack, but has spent this week not just critical of those polls, but also Carson, who he calls low energy. In Boulder, Colorado, Jared Halpern, Fox News Radio.
A Georgia woman was arrested in Fayetteville Tuesday on multiple charges dating back to July 9th. Dundra Merrill, a 24-year-old from Brunswick, Georgia, was charged with multiple counts of assault when she fired a gun into a vehicle, wounding one of the passengers. When confronted, she then opened fire on a police officer. Merrill is now being held at Cumberland County Detention Center. The governor signed one of the last remaining bills from the past legislative session into law at the Guilford County Sheriff's Office this afternoon. That's according to WTVD. HB 318 is a highly controversial bill which prevents local municipalities from adopting sanctuary city status. It also prohibits the use of the matricula consular, a photo ID issued by the Mexican government to nationals outside the country. The bill also prevents DHHS from processing applications for able-bodied adults without children from receiving additional benefits. Norman Smith, a 52-year-old stabbing victim, died last night after being attacked by a 29-year-old in Raleigh. Kevin Peacock from Oklahoma was charged early today in connection to the crime. Authorities say the stabbing was not random. A motive has not been released. Additional information has been released in the death of a 2-year-old Henderson County girl. Abigail Newman was shot in the neck with a 20-gauge shotgun over the weekend. She died at Mission Hospital from her injuries. The homeowner, James Stepp, has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. He turned himself in Monday night. Is the tax man spying on you? It's possible. Fox News Radio's Rachel Sutherland reports from Washington.
The IRS admits it's using cell phone tracking equipment, which can collect metadata, but only in criminal cases.
The use of that is restricted. It's our criminal investigation division that uses that technique.
IRS Commissioner John Koskinen told the Senate Finance Committee the agency has to get a court order to use tracking technology, and he stressed it's used primarily for cases like money laundering, terrorism, and organized crime. Koskinen agreed to tell the committee how often the technology is used within 30 days. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland, Fox News Radio.
And a recent article in USA Today shows that App State is one of only 5 universities in the U.S. offering a degree in brewing beer. and the only one on the East Coast. The Bachelor's of Science in Fermentation Sciences was introduced in 2012. The program focuses on the chemistry aspect of brewing beer and offers an in-depth, hands-on approach where students partner with local breweries and vineyards to simulate their own brewery. Other schools offering a similar degree include Oregon State University, University of California, Davis, Central Washington University, and San Diego State. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of what matters with guest host Elliot Engstrom.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Freedom Action Network. This is Elliot Engstrom here, guest hosting for Chad Adams. And so on the line today, we've got Anthony Rodriguez. Are you there, Anthony?
Hey, Elliot. How are you doing?
Hey, doing all right. So Anthony is the regional director at one of the regional directors at the Young Americans for Liberty, which is a group up in D.C. And so we've also got here, I'm surprised, Anthony, in the studio with me, I have Lauren Bailey, who is a production intern at for the Freedom Action Network here, the radio station we got here.
Hello.
And because we're going to talk about some millennial stuff and kind of, you know, who are they? What do they think? Why do they think it? And basically, you've got to convince me that these aren't just a bunch of people obsessed with their, you know, their iPods and their Halo and their, you know, do millennials matter? I mean, first off, in the upcoming election, do you think in the national presidential election, millennials are going to have a role, or are they just not going to show up?
I personally think that they are going to show up. I think you're starting to see, seeing a lot more millennials being politically involved, with the mounting debt, with issues like student debt being such a big issue on jobs, more millennials are getting involved. And we're starting to see that here at Young Americans for Liberty with our explosive growth that we've had over the past year. We're now reaching up or way past 600 chapters nationwide, all the way from zero when we started back in early 2009.
Okay, so... Because I'm a little bit confused because Lauren here was just telling me she just registered to vote for the first time, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm old. So I'm voting for 40 years, right? And
try again, Elliot.
You know, like less time than that. But anyways, so
I haven't even voted yet.
All these polls come out, and so I would think the candidates that would be bringing in millennials, I think Rand Paul. I think on the right, I think Rand Paul, and then, you know, who else on the Republican side? I think, honestly, Donald Trump probably gets some young people who like his brand of whatever he does. And then, but I see Rand Paul in particular trying to market himself as this like candidate of millennials, and yet a lot of these polls say he's polling so poorly. Like, well, what's the deal?
I think that you're starting to see issues possibly on immigration in some ways, but you're also seeing his embrace of other issues of expanding government, his past dealings with crony capitalism, you know, favoring handouts, favoring eminent domain. Those are issues that millennials don't like.
This is Trump you're talking about?
Yeah, this is
okay.
Trump.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you were talking Rand Paul for a second, and I was like, wait a minute.
Oh, no. I thought you were asking, why Trump?
The reason I ask that is because, you know, here at Civitas, we're, you know, nonpartisan group, and I know Young Americans for Liberty is also a nonpartisan group, but, but you know, you guys were founded by, you know, it was students for Ron Paul's, you know, ancestor or descendant organization, I guess. You got a lot of people who work there who, and, you know, and I don't think there's any problem with that. I mean, you see, like, Organizing for America, it was basically just Obama's campaign turned into a nonprofit that was supposedly nonpartisan, right? But I think there's probably a lot of people in Young Americans for Liberty chapters across the country who kind of like Rand Paul, you know? Is that a fair assessment?
We see obviously all candidates and some of our members aren't as politically involved. I would say that, yes, there are a good portion that do love liberty, and there are some candidates in the field, not that many, I personally think that represent the beliefs of Young Americans for Liberty as a whole.
And I have a caller for you guys. They want to ask a question. It's Natalie from Raleigh.
Natalie from Raleigh. Natalie from Raleigh?
Natalie from Raleigh has a question.
Hi, Natalie from Raleigh.
Thanks for having my question. So it's a quick one. As a young millennial woman, I meet a lot of older people from older generations who assume that I'm liberal or left-leaning because of my age and gender. And I just wanted to ask, do you all think that conservative values are a lost cause for millennials, or is there a way to change millennials' minds?
What do you think, Anthony?
Ooh, I think that there's, in our generation, I think we are conservative, but we really don't know it. I think with our generation, we've had years and years of mounting debt, national debt, and we're sick of it. I think our generation, I think Rand Paul has put it right when, during his time in the Senate, by labeling our generation the leave me alone generation. We want everyone to leave us alone. We want the government out of our pockets. And I think kind of where a lot of millennials split from older generations of conservatives comes from the social issues. We millennials, I don't want to lump us all together, but I would say a majority want the government out of our bedroom and out of our wallets as well, which kind of brings in a new generation of conservatives. Mm-hmm. So I think we are winnable as a generation to get away from the liberals. We just have to be able to focus on what matters most to millennials and, where we can find common ground. I think there's a lot of common ground with a lot of members in the Republican Party to be against the Patriot Act and to be against NSA spying, as well as on other fiscal issues such as the national debt. How much longer can we raise the debt ceiling? It's ridiculous. And I think that resonates with a lot of millennials as well.
Is that a satisfactory answer to your question, Natalie?
Yeah, that's a great answer.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot for calling in.
Thanks Natalie.
Bye.
And so, Anthony, all right. So we got you on here. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, my take would just be that I think polls are relatively useless this far out from an election. So,
I completely agree. Yeah,
but it makes for interesting talking points, at least. But so I know we kind of jumped in real fast and just went, what do you think about this? But let's also talk about, so you're calling in from Young Americans for Liberty in DC.
Sure.
You guys have, do you have chapters in North Carolina?
Absolutely. We have a ton of chapters in North Carolina, all the way from Western Carolina University all the way out to Wilmington. I think we have over 20 chapters in the state of North Carolina alone. A great network of chapters. We're even hosting our first state convention of the year, January 30th at UNC Charlotte, which will be an awesome event. And you can find out more about this at yaliberty.org.
Well, because I think sometimes the concern from the outside looking in a group like Yale is you'll have people who are really smart, hardworking. Not that everybody in the group isn't, but they really make a lot of sense. And then sometimes you'll have people who say they'll use the word like anarchist, or they'll say they're super libertarian or whatever. And you even see people who like reject Rand Paul because he's not libertarian enough, right? And is that like? Is that part of y'all's strategy to just say, you know what, big tent, whatever, bring them all in? Or is it kind of like, is that ever frustrating for you guys when people reject pragmatism 100% in favor of like their particular strain of 100% libertarian politics?
Sure. With Young Americans for Liberty, we are a big tent organization. We bring people in from all sides of the liberty spectrum. There's people that when I was at UNC Charlotte as a student, we brought in people from the left and from the right and people that were already libertarian, people that were originally apathetic and now they're not. And some people that are mainly single issue voters. We've been able to create some great coalitions. And so I don't think it is a problem, because I always say that there's on the spectrum of social change. You can be someone who comes and works really hard at a think tank, at a great organization such as, Civitas or the Institute for Humane Studies or even the Cato Institute, that works on the ideas portion of a free society. And how can we put our conservative values into action? What kind of, you know, what's a good solution to the problems that we have in Washington? Or you can be the person that goes and works on campaigns on the other side of the spectrum that's influencing voters through electoral politics. So there's really so many different ways that people can fit into the movement and to bring liberty, across the country through all generations, including millennial generation.
Yeah.
And that's what we do here at Yale.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good idea. I'll be honest. Sometimes I just, cause I've been around the libertarian movement some, you know, in the past. And I agree with your goals. Sometimes I get frustrated when people will say like, you know, nothing but, you know, 100% libertarianism. But I get that for it to be a Big Ten organization, you've got to bring those kind of people in.
Exactly. But, and there's going to be people that you disagree with along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys just, I mean, it's where you guys just have to work on that common ground. And that's kind of what we try to seek here at Yale, is that common ground to include everyone. Because I feel like everyone has a role. We just don't, you know,
yeah.
With people in college, you just don't know that role yet.
Well, and so I had one last question for you. So I don't think I mentioned this before. You're from North Carolina, right? You said you went to UNCC. Are you from Charlotte?
No, I was born and raised in Maryland.
Okay.
But I went to UNC Charlotte for college, and I was there for a total of 8 years.
Okay.
And kind of really saw, I got involved with in politics and started my Yale group on campus.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So what I'm curious about is you worked for one of the charter school associations itself,
yes,
or something, right?
Yeah, I worked for the NC Public Charter Schools Association.
Because I've actually started hearing rumbles. You know, we just had Bob Lukey on here talking about education savings accounts, and I've actually been hearing rumbles that charter schools might not like education savings accounts because they might have more competition if that's the case. So vouchers are good for charter schools because the money has to go to tuition, right? But the ESAs might open up the market even more, and charter schools might not like it. I don't know, but I think it's an interesting. Is there a possibility that charter schools could be against something like that? I mean, what do you think, or do you have an opinion on that?
It's a mixed bag. It really depends on how you look at it, and it also kind of depends on how the ESAs are run. I know that Arizona has a very unique system for the ESAs where they can use the educational savings account for charter schools so that they're included in it.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's just for expanding choice across the board.
Yeah.
You know, it's really kind of leveling the playing field and putting parental power, first, and putting parents first in how and where their child goes to school and how they spend the money for education. I'm not too familiar with what's going on specifically in North Carolina, mm-hmm. what kind of legislation is being put forward or will be put forward. But with ESAs, you're really kind of just expanding on school choice. And I think charter schools should be excited about that. I think it opens up the doors to more opportunities for students. And charter schools are meant to be incubators of innovation and really kind of offer parents choice. And I think that ESAs, expand that. So I personally don't think that charter schools should be worried about the educational savings account. I think they should be rejoicing that they get to compete in a bigger market. And really, it opens up the door to innovation as well. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, hey, when do you think you're going to be making another trip down to North Carolina?
I am actually going down there for Christmas this year.
Oh.
So we're Brittany and I are headed down to Charlotte, and we'll be there probably for a week over Christmas.
So you get out of Mordor for a few days and get to
come
down
here.
Yeah,
gotta get out of that DC area.
All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot for calling in. That's Anthony Rodriguez, regional director at Young Americans for Liberty.
Thank you so much, Elliot, for having me on today.
No problem. Bye. So that was Anthony. We have another guest coming up in a few minutes, but we're here with Lauren Bailey, our production intern at
the
Freedom Action Network. And so, Lauren, you are, remind me, so you are, you're finishing up high school and starting college at the same time. You're doing kind of a weird,
yeah,
not weird, but different program.
I go to an early college.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm in high school technically, but I take college courses.
Well, that, is that a way to, because, so one other thing with millennials that we didn't get to talk about with Anthony is that college tuition is really, really,
it's
really expensive, right? And it's funny to me, at least, to see like left-winging politicians come out and say this is a problem, because in my opinion, at least, they've created the problem. but that's a whole other discussion for another day. But that's interesting that that's how you're approaching that. Because a lot of people now go to four-year schools because, you know, at least even when I was coming out of high school, the idea was like you go get a college degree. It doesn't matter what it's in, and then you'll be fine and you move on. And I would think that even though I think you and I are both millennials, I would think that maybe your sub-generation or whatever might starting to catch on to the fact that you actually have to like have a skill and be able to do something in order to get a job, you know? And whether that's, that could be a variety of things, right? But I mean, for example, I majored in French in college, and that's cool, right? Whatever. Yeah. I mean, but luckily I always knew I wanted to be an attorney. So that's why I did that. Cause I can't imagine what I do have one friend who, he has a job talking to truckers in Canada, translating French to English. So I guess that's something interesting. But
I have a friend. She goes to UNCG, and she's majoring in international business with a double major in Spanish. Hmm. And she wants to go to Spain and teach Spanish-speaking kids how to speak English. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a Spanish teacher here.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Because, you know, it's we try to get as many millennials as we can involved in, or young people involved in our conferences and everything. You know, we got the Conservative Leadership Conference next year, which you should come to and bring all your friends. But while we got a couple minutes here, I'm also going to fill you in, Lauren, and the rest of the world on one of our recent cases, because I know you really want to know litigation at the Civitas Institute.
Yes.
And so let's see. We've talked about public records. We've talked about wind energy. We have another case. That, let me think. Yeah. This one can be a bit contentious. And so maybe we'll have a caller want to talk about this one. I don't know. But because this one implicates same-sex marriage. It's not about same-sex marriage, but it's a topic that's involved. And so anytime you bring that up, things can get heated.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you might remember I guess it was 2014, the fall or so, the Supreme Court. Actually, maybe it was this year. Anyways, I forget when the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court ruled, but at some point in the recent past, federal courts ruled that same-sex marriage is legal and that, or rather, they ruled that restrictions on same-sex marriage are illegal, right? So that's what they ruled. And we're not dealing with that in any of our cases. It's just kind of like, that's the law. Okay, move on. And we won't get into like, because I think even in this office, there's probably different opinions on that. Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, what happened was, so we're in what's called the Fourth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we're within that federal circuit. The Fourth Circuit told everyone the federal rulings are in place. This is the way it is. Move on with life, right?
Yeah.
When that happened, the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts sent out this, they called a memorandum, I would call it a directive, to all magistrates saying you must perform same-sex marriages or you, even if you have a religious objection, you likely will face criminal prosecution. You could face civil damages. You can face all this different stuff, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So two magistrates said, look at this. And this is before the General Assembly did anything on the issue. They looked at this and they said, I have a religious objection. I can't do that. They left their jobs. Mm-hmm. They just said, we can't do this, right?
Or they stayed and then refused to issue licenses.
Well, so the guys I'm talking to, actually it's interesting because it's two different things, right? So in Kentucky, we had Kim Davis, who stayed and said, I'm not going to issue licenses. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't know what opinions are in the office. Personally, I'm not okay with that because it's like, do your job, you know? Mm-hmm. But we had two magistrates who said, well, we want to opt out of all marriages. We don't want to perform any marriage ceremonies, but we also want to, at the same time, make sure that same-sex couples have access to marriages. Mm-hmm. And that way we can protect our religious liberties under the North Carolina Constitution. Yeah. And at the same time, we can provide everyone with legal access to marriages, right? Mm-hmm. So they asked the Administrative Office of the Courts, can we do this? And the AOC said, no, you can't. So they resigned their posts. And now we have this lawsuit that was filed by a guy named Ellis Boyle in 2015, attorney in Raleigh, saying that memorandum from the AOC was illegal. Mm-hmm. That for them to send out a directive like that to these magistrates saying this is illegal, mm-hmm. one, because the AOC exerted improper authority over magistrates, and then two, because it was an improper statement of law under the North Carolina Constitution.
Yeah.
So Ellis took this to the trial court, this attorney in Raleigh, and it got dismissed pretty early on at what's called a 12B hearing, which we won't get into that, but basically means very early on the judge said, no, you're wrong, plaintiffs, you lose. So we have jumped in with Ellis to take this up to the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason it's a contentious issue is just because same-sex marriage is involved.
Yeah.
We've been very clear, though, in our releases and everything to say we're not challenging whether same-sex couples can get married. We're challenging whether the administrative office of the courts was within its rights to reach out to these magistrates and say, you must do this, or criminal prosecution, civil prosecution. Because it's interesting, their counterargument has been, we don't do criminal prosecutions, we don't do civil prosecutions, therefore you're pointing your finger at the wrong person.
Then it sounds like they overstepped their bounds.
Well, we're saying, then why'd you come out and say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting case, and we're going up to the Court of Appeals on the issues of, you know, mainly on the issue of whether the AOC is somebody that can be held responsible for doing this kind of thing. And part of the problem with going over the litigation stuff on the radio is I've got to think of a better way to, like, simplify it. Not because listeners are not smart or something like that, but just because it takes a long time to lay out, like, everything that's happening.
Actually, you're doing a great job.
I'm trying.
But compared to the Kentucky case, you know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and so one thing people point out a lot is, like, what about separation of church and state, right? That is something I could talk about ad nauseum, but I won't. But so okay, there's two things to look at. There's federal constitutional laws on separation of church and state,
mm-hmm.
and there's state constitutional laws on separation of church and state. And I would also say there's parallel laws on religious liberty, right?
Yeah.
So there's the federal constitution's, honestly, isn't really a huge issue here because this case is under the North Carolina Constitution. And it's really interesting. First Amendment litigation on religious issues in federal courts, probably every day. I don't know, there's probably a case mm-hmm. pending, right? The last time that these clauses that we're arguing about in the North Carolina Constitution were authoritatively ruled on by a North Carolina appellate court, I think was 1996, I think. Because people,
that was before I was born.
Well, yeah, I mean, because people don't bring lawsuits under the North Carolina Constitution a lot. Our argument is that there are more protections for religious liberty in the North Carolina Constitution than in the federal Constitution. As far as separation of church and state, I'm actually reading a book on this right now by a guy named Donald Drakeman about what was meant by the Establishment Clause.
Mm-hmm.
And so, personally, I think that on the left, people have gone way too far out, and the court's gone way too far out on what was meant, what was intended by the framers when they said, you know, Congress shall establish, what is the exact phrase, and shall establish no religion, but shall also not impede the free exercise of religion, right?
Yeah.
So both those things have to be met. So immediately, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. You have to serve both those interests, right? You can't establish religion, you can't impede free exercise.
Yeah.
My personal opinion is that the First Amendment, as the framers understood it, just meant that the federal government can't establish a church like the Church of England. That's my personal take on it. There's stuff out there about language. You know, Thomas Jefferson wrote this stuff about a wall of separation between church and state, but he wrote that years after the Constitution was written. And you got to remember, at these meetings where they talked about separation of church and state in the Continental Congress, they opened with prayer. State-paid pastors, chaplains at these things. These were not people who – it's amazing to me when people talk about how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, all these guys were hardcore deists
mm-hmm.
because why'd they pray?
Right.
I don't – I mean, I think that Thomas Jefferson's religious beliefs at least are really weird and nuanced and complicated,
yeah.
and I'm not going to get into that on the air. And then, you know, Thomas Paine, my understanding is that he was an atheist, but I do think there's a lot of Christian roots in our nation. I think on mm-hmm. the left, they tried to write that out and act like it was, but it's a really interesting issue, though. And honestly, and that's not to say there are religious people on the left, right? So that's not mm-hmm. to say that, but I think for the secular left, I think a lot of it comes down to the thought that religion is just a bunch of bunk.
Well, Elliot, question here. Really, should the U.S. Supreme Court have ever made that decision to begin with when it came down to same-sex marriage? Should they have ever issued that edict?
So here's my thought. And I'm a little bit libertarian leaning on this stuff. I don't necessarily always mirror my personal beliefs with my political beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. So if they were going to make that edict, I think that it should have been 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause, same-sex mm-hmm. couples are similarly situated to heterosexual couples, therefore they should be treated similarly.
Yeah.
That's it. But Justice Kennedy wasn't writing for a logical opinion. Mm-hmm. Justice Kennedy wanted to be quoted on Twitter with rainbows.
Right.
He wanted the language about...
He wanted Facebook pictures exactly. with people in front of rainbows and stuff,
so his
right.
decision doesn't really, at least maybe I'm just missing it, but there's not really a lot of like logical, here's what the law says, and it follows this, it follows this, it follows this. Because I think they easily could have just said 14th Amendment. I mean, they've expanded the 14th Amendment a lot over the years, expanded it relatively recently to include Second Amendment protections, which right. I don't think many conservatives were upset about that.
No.
But I think that would have been the easy way to do it, just say 14th Amendment protects the right to same-sex marriage.
Instead of
but
expounding on
instead
it.
Instead of going, because I wonder what people... I wonder what clever lawyers are going to take out of that case now as precedent
mm-hmm.
when you write a decision like that. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm okay with the result, actually. And that's a conversation maybe for another day.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as far as the jurisprudence goes, I'm a little bit off. But I think that I'm talking into our break now. So
yeah, but that's perfect. That's an excellent conversation.
Well, mm-hmm. we'll hop off and then we'll be back with Jonathan Jones from the Open Government Coalition in just a few minutes.
Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. A South Carolina school officer has been fired after video showed him flipping an allegedly disruptive teen backward out of her desk and tossing her across the classroom. Richland County Senior Deputy Ben Fields was first suspended after the incident went public. He was released from his job late this morning. Sheriff Leon Lott says Fields did not follow proper procedures and training. The student had been told by a teacher and administrator to leave the classroom, but refused to do so. She also refused the deputy who told her she was under arrest. After her continued refusal to leave, the incident that led to his firing occurred. The FBI has begun a civil rights investigation at the sheriff's request. An autopsy detailing how a 17-year-old Durham girl was killed has been released. The report shows Tierra Hall was stabbed 14 times in the head, neck, shoulder, and arm, then left to die in a vacant home. The medical examiner noted the attack was so brutal, the tip of the knife broke off in the victim's cheek. Hall's former boyfriend, Kelton Fox, also 17, has been charged with first-degree murder in her death. For the third time, Republicans looking to become president square off, this time with a new front runner. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern has more from Boulder, Colorado.
As has been the case twice already, the large Republican field is split into two groups, the higher polling 10 candidates in prime time, the lower polling 4 in an earlier undercard. Both stages will look nearly the same as last month, minus Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who has ended his bid. What is different? The top of the GOP field, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, now leading a few polls in Iowa and a new national CBS New York Times poll. Trump is still running second, well ahead of the rest of the pack, but has spent this week not just critical of those polls, but also Carson, who he calls low energy. In Boulder, Colorado, Jared Halpern, Fox News Radio.
A Georgia woman was arrested in Fayetteville Tuesday on multiple charges dating back to July 9th. Dundra Merrill, a 24-year-old from Brunswick, Georgia, was charged with multiple counts of assault when she fired a gun into a vehicle, wounding one of the passengers. When confronted, she then opened fire on a police officer. Merrill is now being held at Cumberland County Detention Center. The governor signed one of the last remaining bills from the past legislative session into law at the Guilford County Sheriff's Office this afternoon. That's according to WTVD. HB 318 is a highly controversial bill which prevents local municipalities from adopting sanctuary city status. It also prohibits the use of the matricula consular, a photo ID issued by the Mexican government to nationals outside the country. The bill also prevents DHHS from processing applications for able-bodied adults without children from receiving additional benefits. Norman Smith, a 52-year-old stabbing victim, died last night after being attacked by a 29-year-old in Raleigh. Kevin Peacock from Oklahoma was charged early today in connection to the crime. Authorities say the stabbing was not random. A motive has not been released. Additional information has been released in the death of a 2-year-old Henderson County girl. Abigail Newman was shot in the neck with a 20-gauge shotgun over the weekend. She died at Mission Hospital from her injuries. The homeowner, James Stepp, has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. He turned himself in Monday night. Is the tax man spying on you? It's possible. Fox News Radio's Rachel Sutherland reports from Washington.
The IRS admits it's using cell phone tracking equipment, which can collect metadata, but only in criminal cases.
The use of that is restricted. It's our criminal investigation division that uses that technique.
IRS Commissioner John Koskinen told the Senate Finance Committee the agency has to get a court order to use tracking technology, and he stressed it's used primarily for cases like money laundering, terrorism, and organized crime. Koskinen agreed to tell the committee how often the technology is used within 30 days. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland, Fox News Radio.
And a recent article in USA Today shows that App State is one of only 5 universities in the U.S. offering a degree in brewing beer, and the only one on the East Coast. The Bachelor's of Science in Fermentation Sciences was introduced in 2012. The program focuses on the chemistry aspect of brewing beer and offers an in-depth, hands-on approach where students partner with local breweries and vineyards to simulate their own brewery. Other schools offering a similar degree include Oregon State University, University of California, Davis, Central Washington University, and San Diego State. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with guest host Elliot Engstrom.
Welcome back to the Freedom Action Network. I'm Elliot Engstrom, filling in today for Chad Adams. And we have our next guest on the line, I believe, Jonathan Jones from the Open Government Coalition. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Elliot, and thanks for having me this afternoon.
Yeah, no problem. So you're over at Elon University, right?
Yes, the North Carolina Open Government Coalition is housed in Elon University's School of Communications, but we're separate from the university.
It's separate from the university. And what do you guys? So, do you guys litigate? Do you educational stuff? Like, what kind of stuff do you do?
So, we primarily exist to educate people about open government laws in North Carolina, the open meetings law and the open records law. On a rare occasion, we will consider filing a friend of the court brief in a lawsuit, but we're not going to go out and file a lawsuit.
Okay.
And then the other thing that we do is we have a hotline where if someone's having a problem, they can call us up and we'll help explain the law to them.
And so you guys aren't like an anti-government group. You're more about facilitating, because you work with government groups and non-government groups, right, on public records issues?
Yes. So, okay. In fact, some of our member organizations are government agencies. We have a number of government employees who are members. We aren't anti-government. We believe in good government is transparent government, and so we work with anyone who is willing to partner with us on that, you know, whether that is a government agency or a group of journalists or a group of citizens, a policy group, whoever is interested in transparency, we're willing to work with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And yeah, actually, thinking back now, I was actually at your annual event. I think it was at the beginning of this year or the end of last year, and Attorney General Roy Cooper was your speaker. So I guess, there must have been government actors there, because I know he works in the government. So that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. That was our Sunshine Day event, our annual Sunshine Day event. What happens in the second week of March. And, you know, of course, as you know, Attorney General Cooper has a role in the transparency system here in North Carolina, because one of his jobs is to interpret the open records and open meetings laws for government agencies when they need help with it.
Okay. Well, so first thing I wanted to ask you about was I noticed there was an article today, actually, in the, I think it's a Charlotte Observer or the News and Observer, quoting you about a new Councilman-elect David Cox in Raleigh has said he's going to set up a private email account to protect the privacy of his constituents if they want to come to him with issues related to government. Now, what's your take on this? Is that, first off, is that a good idea? And then second off, in your opinion, is that something that is legal?
So generally, I would advise government elected officials, I should say, as well as government employees, from using their personal email accounts to conduct government business.
Okay.
It Sometimes it's necessary. We have some small towns in North Carolina that just aren't going to have the information technology resources to set up an email account for their town council members. And so there are situations where elected folks have and do need to use their own personal email accounts to conduct government business. But it's generally not a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so, and I advise folks not to do it. The reason it's not a good idea is because those, simply by using a private email doesn't remove your responsibilities under the public records law. Those emails that you send or receive that are related to your work are still public records, and they're still subject to the public records law, even though it might be on, you know, Gmail servers instead of the city of Raleigh server.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and that's where the problem comes in, because it makes it difficult for public records requesters to get access to what are clearly public records.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of your question, though, is it legal? And yes, it is legal to use a non-government email account. It's just it can create problems, and so that's why it's a bad idea. A lot of the government folks, like at the School of Government, who do training for government employees on public records, would advise newly elected council members if they're going to use a personal account, to make sure that they copy their work account on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because so, this interested me that I heard from sorry, I'm rambling. The UNC Board of Governors is a group of people who oversee the UNC system, right? Recently, there was a public records request filed for their private email accounts for anything related to their jobs as UNC Board of Governor members, right? And so that should be, I mean, those emails are public records, right? I mean, I guess even if they're using their private email, if they're talking about stuff that they do in their capacity as Board of Governors members, then are those public records?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And they are subject to the public record law.
Okay.
So, you know, that's why a lot of the larger organizations will go ahead and set up a separate email account for people in positions like that. I don't know if the Board of Governors has done that or not. I take it they haven't. But and even when there's a separate account set up, as you know, I don't know about you, but I've got a work email address and I've got the email that I use at home.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just start thinking about it and you end up using, you know, your personal email to send something work related, or use your work email to send something that's, you know, more personal. And so it does happen where even if you have set things up, you know, business can get crossed between those separate accounts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I even think about the fact that anytime anybody at Civitas communicates with a government employee, I guess it's all a public record, right?
For the most part.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the next thing I wanted to quickly ask you about is this. Gosh, I guess it's been, what, 1 or 2 months since the lawsuit was filed against Governor McCrory, the public records lawsuit?
The response just was filed by Governor McCrory's team last month. Okay. And I think the lawsuit itself was filed in August, if I recall correctly.
Oh, gosh, so it's been a little while. Okay. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't looked at it as much as I honestly should have, but that it mainly has to do with delay. And the question is whether there has been too much of a delay. And so is it kind of like there's – because from McCrory's people, I hear, well, these are gigantic record requests. And then from the requesters, I hear, well, they're not big enough to be taking as long as they're taking. Is that sort of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I hear sort of similar things from both sides. The you know, the issue here is how long does it take to fulfill a records request? And in North Carolina, there's no set time limit. Some states have a time limit. In North Carolina, what the law says is that a records request has to be filled as promptly as possible. Mm-hmm. That's the phrase. And so what's happened here is that we have some records requests that are taking, you know, 10 months, a year. A few have taken, you know, 15, 18 months for some of the executive agencies to fulfill, and the mostly media outlets, but there's also a couple of policy groups that have joined this lawsuit, are saying, look, that's too long, that it should not take a year to fulfill this records request. We acknowledge it's a big request. That's why we've been patient for, you know, more than 6 months. But mm-hmm. there is a point where that request needs to be fulfilled. And the timing can be important because, you know, one of the things we've seen with some of the delays is that whether it's intentional or because of the size of the request or some other reason, that by the time the request is fulfilled, the sort of, the, at least for the news organizations, the news value of that information has dissipated.
Yeah.
And so it's no longer a story.
And so for, cause, so for the court to rule in that case, I mean, it seems like they're either going to have to say they did fulfill requests as promptly as possible or they did not fulfill requests as promptly as possible. So it seems like we'd get some sort of ruling on what that means, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that makes this an interesting case, is it's going to be, it has potential to be the first time where our courts give us some guidance on what that phrase means for practical purposes. You know, one of the reasons why folks agreed to the as promptly as possible language back when the records law was crafted was because they wanted to create a flexible standard so that if you requested something that does take, you know, 6 months to put together, there's not going to be any penalty for doing that. This was a huge request. It took a while. But also, if you have requested something that's fairly simple and routine, that it would encourage government agencies to fulfill that request quickly. Because
did we lose him? Jonathan?
I think we lost him.
I think we lost Jonathan. But we will... I
can hear you all. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now. Yeah, sorry about that. Something happened there. But so we were talking about the as promptly as possible language, and the courts might give us some kind of guidance as to what that means, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, okay. And that's one of the things that makes this case important, is that we'll finally get some guidance as to, you know, what that means for practical purposes.
Okay. And one idea I've heard... floating around is that is to have a database where when government actors send emails, unless they mark them as privileged or something like that, it just goes into the database, and instead of having to file a public records request, everybody can just go search. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be pros and cons with that, but have you heard that idea, or is that just...
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one that I fully support. It would take a fundamental change in how government employees use email. But it could solve this problem of we've asked for email and an email takes so much time to go through. And the way it would work that I've heard it proposed and I think is perhaps practical is that we train employees that on the front end, you flag emails. If you think this email is exempt from the public records law, then you flag it. And if it gets flagged, then it gets sent off to one bin. And if it doesn't get flagged, it gets sent off to a second bin. And the emails that don't get flagged are just automatically turned over when somebody asks for a request. There's no review necessary by, you know, a public relations officer or by an attorney in the agency's office. And so, and then those attorneys, those public relations folks, are able to focus their attention on the emails that the government employees have actually flagged, the ones that potentially are exempt. And spend their time looking at those, and greatly reduce the fairly routine number of emails that they're having to sit there and review now, but that aren't subject to any exemption under the public records law.
What would happen if a government employee flags something as public, and then it turns out they were wrong?
Well, and that's the risk with it.
Okay,
that's if there was something, let's say, someone in the Department of Health and Human Services forgot to flag, you know, an email that contained medical records of an individual and that got released. That's the potential danger there. And so that's where we have to have training on the front end with the employees to understand the importance of, when they should be flagging things and when they shouldn't.
Well, you know, thinking back to the as promptly as possible language, I do public records litigation here, and I threatened one lawsuit against a government agency saying, we're going to seek a declaratory judgment that you have not responded as promptly as possible. And they actually pretty much overnight gave me the records I wanted, which made me think that maybe, I don't know, maybe some government actors don't want, you know, courts to interpret that because they're worried it could put even more pressure on them. But
I think that's probably right, because in at least some of these delays that we're seeing, it's going to be very hard to support that this records request has been fulfilled as promptly as possible. And right now, with this language being uninterpreted and having a great deal of wiggle room in it, you know, that works in the benefit of the government agencies. But if we get, you know, some clear guidance from the courts that say, you know, no, this is unreasonable, or this is a test for how we figure out what's unreasonable, that has potential to put a lot more pressure on government agencies to fulfill their requests in a more timely manner.
Well, my last question for you is, looking at our sunshine laws, our transparency laws, if you could take out or add one thing, what would it be?
The one thing that I would do is I would greatly reduce our law enforcement exemption. Right now in North Carolina, we have one of the biggest law enforcement exemptions in the country. The General Assembly just made it even larger in the last session. And the net effect of that is it makes it very difficult for citizens to have any idea about how well their police departments are investigating crimes that have been reported to them. And, you know, the fear of making that exemption much smaller so that the police have to turn over more information is that it would hinder prosecutions. And I think that's a legitimate fear, but we can look to other states where they have a much greater deal of information becomes public, and they are still able to quite successfully prosecute criminals. And so, I think that tells us or instructs us that that it is possible, and that this information can be made public without endangering the ability of law enforcement to do their job.
And you were a prosecutor, right, before going over to Elon?
Yes, I worked for a couple of years in the Durham District Attorney's Office.
Okay, that's because you probably have an interesting perspective on that. That's interesting. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot for coming on, and we look forward to having you on again sometime soon.
Sure, and thanks again for having me. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Yep, see you. All right, well, that was Jonathan Jones with the Open Government Coalition. And I tell you what, when they do their Sunshine Day event, it is a merry group of people in that room, because you end up with people from Civitas, people from is it Policy Watch, one of the left leaning organizations.
Probably, yeah.
You have we had Roy Cooper in the room. You have people from all different sides, because the Open Government Center, a lot of what they do is facilitate conversations between all these groups, and kind of which I think maybe is part of. I haven't asked Jonathan this, but I would think that maybe that's part of why they don't litigate, because they want government actors to feel comfortable talking to them, you know.
Oh, that makes sense.
And don't think maybe I'm talking to somebody who's going to sue me tomorrow.
yeah.
But, for our last few minutes, I will fill you in briefly on a few more things we're doing here at the Center for Law and Freedom before we hop off the lines. And, in fact, one of the first things we did here was file an amicus brief in a case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this will give you a little bit of a background into occupational licensure. So, Lauren, when you think licensure, because I know you're not a lawyer and you're not a policy wonk. So when you think licensure, what do you think of? The government licensing, requiring someone to get a license to do something. What does that mean to you? It's like driving or what?
Well, the first thing that does come to my mind is driving.
Yeah.
But another thing is like getting married or like opening a business or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So perfect. So a license is basically government saying, if you want to do this, you have to get a certificate from us saying you can do it.
That you're right? Capable.
Yeah. You're capable that you've met all these requirements or whatever. So North Carolina, there's something called occupational licensure, where if you want to enter into an occupation, you have to get a certificate, right? So I'm an attorney. I had to pass the bar, right?
Yeah.
If you want to be a doctor, you've got to pass your boards. Or
yeah.
Whatnot. Excuse me. And so I don't believe, you know, I don't know off the top of my head if there's actually a state statute saying like a doctor must pass their boards. But what it'll do is it'll empower an agency or a licensing board to promulgate regulations as to what you have to do to be a doctor, right? Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't just lawyers and doctors. This is cement spreaders, barbers, cosmetologists, all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't even imagine.
You have to take a class to be a lifeguard.
Yeah, well, and that's one, that's okay. But
yeah,
necessarily. But the question is, here's the question though. If there wasn't a government law saying you have to take a class to be a lifeguard,
oh my gosh.
Do you think that means the lifeguards would just stop, like there would cease being lifeguarding classes?
No.
Yeah, it'd still exist, right? Because if I have a pool, I'm not going to hire just Joe Schmo over there to sit there.
And if you did, then I would not swim in that pool.
And if I hired someone who was not fit to be a lifeguard, and you come to my pool and you get hurt, you can sue me. You can come after me. Absent licensing laws, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a question of whether this is a fundamental distrust of the free market. It's a philosophical idea of the market's not going to protect us. We need licensing laws to protect us because these things are always passed under the guise of consumer safety. So one of the first things we did at the Center for Law and Freedom, when we didn't really have our litigation capacity like ramped up yet, so we weren't really ready to go to court and do all that. We were writing briefs, amicus briefs, to courts on various issues. And there was a case out of Arizona where have you ever had a pedicure done or a manicure?
Yes.
Okay. have you heard of the fish that'll nibble on feet?
Yes, and it freaks me out.
Have you ever had it done?
No.
Okay. All right. So in Arizona, there was a lady named Cindy Vong, and she was doing this in her spa called La Vie. It was the name of her spa. And you stick your feet in this tank, and it's actually not technically a pedicure.
And the fish nibble off the dead skin on your feet.
They call it a fish pedicure, but it's not technically a pedicure, right?
Gross.
And the fish come nibble on your feet. They're Gara Rufa fish. I think they're related to carp or something like that. She imported them. She met all the requirements or whatever. She brought these guys in. And then the Board of Cosmetology of Arizona came to her door, knocked on her door, and said, you can't do that. That's illegal. This is not safe. You can't do it. So... interesting stuff. First off, Cindy Vong said to them, well, it seems like you guys don't have any rules on the books about this. So why don't you use me as your test case and then promulgate regulations based on what happens in my spa?
Yeah.
They said, no, we do have rules on the books about this. And that rule is that any instrument used in a pedicure must be sterilized. Well, how do you sterilize a fish?
You don't.
You basically incinerate it, right? I mean, I don't know how do you...
Boil it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't sterilize something organic. So they're saying we do have rules on the books, and those rules say you can't do this.
Yeah.
Whereas she's saying, no, you need to write new rules about this. And by the way, one thing I should mention is the Board of Cosmetology, licensing boards in general, who do you think... So the Barber Board of North Carolina.
Yeah.
Off the top of your head, just like layman's knowledge, who would you think is on the Barber Board?
Barbers.
Barbers, right? Okay, so if you're a barber and you can actually decide what your competition is legally allowed to do and whether they're allowed to enter the market, it seems like kind of conflict of interest stuff comes up.
Yeah, they need an unaffected third-party observer for that.
And again, I would say that's the consumer. But anyway, so Board of Cosmetology in Arizona is made up of a bunch of cosmetologists. They come in and say she can't do this. And they say safety. They say, this isn't safe. You can't have these fish nibble on people's feet. They're going to get fish diseases and lose their feet and get gangrene and all this crazy stuff, right? So,
well, I mean, if you think about diseases that are transferred from skin contact, if a fish has its mouth on somebody's skin and you use the same fish on somebody else's skin, it doesn't it work like that, kind of?
Well, if you use the same blade to do a pedicure on two different people, isn't
a blade can be sterilized.
No.
It can't?
Wrong.
Oh,
no,
thanks,
a blade can't be sterilized, but the fish is fine.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, so... Here's the idea.
Fishes are also slimy and salmonella's nest.
The idea would be that there would be some sort of new set of regulations about how to... And so so the Goldwater Institute out in Arizona filed suit on behalf of Cindy Vong and said this is ridiculous that they're saying she can't do this. The Board of Cosmetology, despite the fact that these fish pedicures are a thing all over the country and in other countries, the Board of Cosmetology could not find a single example anywhere of anyone ever getting sick, getting hurt, anything from a fish pedicure. Meanwhile, people are getting tetanus. People are getting all kinds of diseases from regular pedicures.
I think, in fact, Paula Lopez got some kind of incredible disease from a contaminated file.
Yeah, I mean, so this lawsuit was filed.
Have you seen the pictures of like the nail fungus people get when they use the other nail files?
I have never seen those pictures. That sounds
okay. Don't Google it.
I will not Google it.
Okay.
But it sounds gross. But so this lawsuit was filed in 2009 in Arizona. In 2010, over in the United Kingdom, they were having some similar thoughts about, is this okay? So in the United Kingdom, they did a worldwide survey to try to find, you know, let's look at the examples of problems that have arisen as a result of fish pedicures. And they couldn't find one example in the United Kingdom anywhere in the world of somebody getting sick. Their only finding was that if you take a cup, or actually if you dunk your head in the water and drink it while the fish are in it, you can get sick. Therefore, it's not safe, right?
Yeah, that's like a duh.
So the question is, in the absence of evidence that this is dangerous at all, is it still okay for the government to just say, no, you can't do it?
Yes.
Is there anything about that that is unconstitutional, right?
No.
Well, okay. So,
well, in my opinion, no.
So the government should be able to just outlaw fish pedicures?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
I think yes, no. Because they're nasty.
Okay. Well, that's good. And actually, we're going to find out who, you know, agrees with her. So the Arizona courts agreed with Lauren, mm-hmm. actually, because fish pedicures are nasty. They agreed because they said that government actors, there's massive deference to government actors, and if they want to outlaw something, they can outlaw it, and if you don't like it, you can vote them out.
Well,
right?
That, and it takes one case to shut everything down.
So that's interesting, though. Because so, then why is it okay to do regular pedicures, and why is it okay to go out to restaurants and all this other stuff when people are getting sick all the time?
Well, good question.
That would
that's
be the
a good question.
Because they should just shut it all down, right? Just
well, I guess it's kind of a sense of nobody wants to do anything that they don't know.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about fish or fish pedicures on my feet. So yeah. Just the sheer thought of a fish ingesting my dead skin on my feet, not that there's much there, but anyway, mm-hmm. it's just makes my skin crawl.
Well, so anyways, this case went up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and our question was, can you completely economically prohibit something under the guise of safety and have no evidence that it's actually dangerous?
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court ended up saying that yes, they can. It's not a problem with due process, and it was disappointing for us, but it was our first jump into the world of brief writing, and we worked with the Cato Institute and did this on this Goldwater Institute case, and it was, you know, that was kind of our jumping off point. And in fact, this is my jumping off point to get off the radio. So thank you for tuning in today to What Matters with Elliot Engstrom, guest host, and I'll talk to you guys soon.